We are at the top of the hour at this time, so I would like to introduce our two presenters. We are very lucky today to have Dr. Lori Bastian. She's a senior research associate at VA Connecticut Healthcare System at the Newington campus. She's also a professor in the division chief of general internal medicine and associate dean for career development at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Joining her today, we have Dr. Chloe Bird. She's a senior sociologist at the RAND Corporation and also a professor at Party RAND Graduate School. So we're thankful to have both of them joining us today. And Dr. Bird, are you ready to share your screen?
I am.
Excellent. Great.
All right. So today, Lori and I will be talking to you about the responsibilities, challenges, and tips from an editor's perspective, actually from many editors' perspectives, being a journal reviewer. So the slides, first we want to give credit. We started with a deck of slides from multiple talks that Elsevier provides, and we've built everything onto that, but not all of this is from Elsevier. Lori gathered a lot of information, slides, and suggestions from colleagues at JGM and otherwise, and so these are all brought together. Any errors or limitations are our own, but we are very grateful to the journals and the publishers and our colleagues for their willingness to share their slides. The presentation, we're going to start with why to be a reviewer, what makes a good reviewer, how you can be a good reviewer, what an editor wants from a reviewer. We're going to briefly discuss some of the ethical considerations and how to tell and what to do when you are the wrong reviewer. We're also going to take turns going back and forth talking on different sections, so you won't be hearing from me the entire time. I'm going to start with some poll questions. The first is, are you a career development awardee?
Thank you very much. So for our attendees, you should see that poll question up on your screen at this time. So are you a career development awardee? Yes or no? No middle ground on this one. And we've got a very responsive group, so thank you kindly. Looks like almost 90% of our audience has responded. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll, and I'll share those results. And Chloe, can you see those?
Yes. So almost two-thirds of the audience is career development awardees, and we didn't ask what the others are, but we've got a third who are not. We'll try to speak to both audiences. Can we go directly to the next poll question?
Absolutely. Okay, so we have the next question up, which is, what is your experience reviewing manuscripts for journals? Have you reviewed no manuscripts, 1 to 2, 3 to 4, or 5 or more? And again, we have a very responsive audience, so thank you very much. It helps give our presenters an idea of how much experience you've had and how to level the talk. All right, already 94% have voted. That's great. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll now, and I'll share those results.
So it looks like 19% have not reviewed, 6% have done 3 or 4, and 75% of you have reviewed 5 or more. Probably many of you do that many a year. Thank you. Let's go back to the slides. Do I need a box to... There. Take control again. All right. So, why is it important to be a reviewer? As a career development awardee, you have more time to publish. This is expected to be part of your work, and part of being part of that community is contributing back and reviewing as you're submitting articles that need to be reviewed. This is part of what is expected as you publish during your career development award. So you should anticipate or already be serving as a reviewer, particularly at places where you're submitting articles and journals that you follow regularly. Once you have considerable experience serving as a reviewer, you may also be asked to serve as a deputy editor for one of the journals. Let's see. So reviewing in your career, one of the reasons to participate in reviewing is it's a way to sharpen your skills. You see what's going on out there. You see other ways people are writing, and you maintain the critical appraisal skills that are helpful in guiding your own work and in the comments you give your colleagues, or the putting on your own editor hat and looking at your manuscript and developing it. Consequently, this can help you learn to write better. As you see a wide range of articles, especially new submissions, you can see how people do things differently, what works, apply what you like, and what works well, and leave out what you don't with your writing. It's also important for promotion and tenure. And now probably, in all honesty, that is not important unless you are notably commended or frequently review for top-tier journals. But if that's where you're trying to publish, you should be involved in doing some reviews for those. However, it will look bad if you don't do any reviews, and you're missing an opportunity to be learning something. As far as reviewing and your life, when we move past the career goals, ideally you'll have some personal enjoyment from this. It's a chance to contribute a little bit to articles, to manuscripts that are relevant to your areas of research and interests. It's relatively manageable time-wise. I often do some of my reviews while I'm on airplane flights. You should be able to set aside a set of time to begin, complete, and do a review, even if that means you make, you know, a couple of passes through an article. But it's a small piece that's giving something to the discipline. So like going to meetings, you learn about the latest research, and you're a participant in your scientific community. And reviewing is important to you and to your scientific community. Publishing valid data is what we're all about. This is you can think of your career and your research as contributing to a conversation of work, and these published pieces are important markers. And so this is your role or your opportunity to contribute to other pieces that are out there. Optimistically, each article averages 5 or so peer reviewers prior to publication, because there's usually a second submission on average, or other reviewers brought in because the first two didn't have all the expertise that was needed. And many articles go to, as you're probably well aware, a few journals before you get to the right place. Every time it takes finding a couple of the right reviewers. So as a result, because you rely on the work of other reviewers, because they contribute to yours, it's also your responsibility as a member of the community, one, to make sure that valid clinical studies get published, so that patient care can be improved, so that science can be advanced, depending on what aspect your work is involved in. You're both enhancing and helping move good work forward, and giving comments that can improve good papers through critique. It's also an important part of the role to say when something is invalid or does not contribute sufficiently, that it either doesn't get published or that it goes to another journal where it might be more suited to the conversation, to the work that's going on in that journal's research community. This is a way of your giving back. What makes a good reviewer? Clearly, we need expertise in one or more areas of the paper. It's not always the case that you have to have all of this highly specialized knowledge, and it's rare that we get every reviewer for a given manuscript that have expertise in all aspects of a paper. But it's very important that you have either clinical, some kind of substantive knowledge related to the paper, or methodological knowledge, so that you can say something that speaks to it as from some level of expertise. It's also critical that you have no conflicts of interest. You're not a friend of one of the authors for most journals, that you're not at the same institution. We'll talk a little bit more later on about other aspects of conflicts of interest. It helps immensely if you are familiar with the journal and what kind of work it publishes, because it may be a matter of making sure a paper gets to the journal where it has a right fit, and that you have some familiarity and ease with what the organization and style of the journal is. It's not that we expect high levels of such detailed comments from people, but it can be important to say, you know, in this journal, that discussion usually belongs at the end, or more of that information would usually be provided at the beginning. Those things are disciplinary differences, but there's styles that are specific to each journal. You need to be able to write a good critique. That doesn't mean that it is long and verbose, but it needs to be accurate. It needs to be readable, and it needs to be constructive. It could be organized around bullet points or chronologically through the, you know, going page by page through the paper. But you need to be able to give precise, clear, constructive feedback to the authors. And ideally, it's consistent with what you say to the editors about the article as well. And last but not least, that you can provide reliable and timely reviews. We very much need to get reviews back on time, because by the time we found you as a reviewer, it may have taken some time and asking many people to get the right person with the right skill set. So not getting a review back on time is as frustrating to the author as it is to you when you're the one not getting a review back. As a reviewer, we expect you to declare if you realize you have a conflict of interest, or a potential conflict of interest. In some cases, we may say, well, that's not specifically a problem if you can overcome it, but in either case, you should let the editorial office know if you have any concerns that you might have a conflict of interest. And certainly there are times where you feel that it would be inappropriate for you to review a manuscript, and you can just say so and decline. You need to treat manuscripts as a confidential document. This is pre-publication. This is someone's work in development, and it's their intellectual property, so you should not use any of the work. Certainly you can draw on it after it's published, wherever it's published, but it is not there as your reference material in the meantime. You should also not communicate directly with the authors. This is part of the process, whether you're going through a blinded review or not. Everything should be handled formally through the journal. Now, there's several dilemmas that reviewers face. The first one we talked about is reviewing. Sometimes the reviewer is too critical, or they're not critical enough. You need to avoid dismissive and snotty language. In my own case, I try to go back and reread the review with the hat of a sensitive author. I think of me. Would any of this come off as off-putting and counterproductive? It should just be the facts. Identify the article's goals and address the relevant review guidelines. That means being familiar with what the journal wants, and does the article achieve what it lays out? It's what it promises to do. Sometimes just correcting that mismatch can make a paper suitable. You need to read each section carefully and be familiar with it, just as you would if you were a grant proposal reviewer. You need to separate the critique of language and style from methodological issues. I typically write about the substantive area, the background, the literature, the methods issues separately. And if there are concerns about either the quality of writing, the nature of the language, or the intensity of the statement of the findings and their implications, those should go in separate sections of your reviews and not just be all balled together. You should reread your review before submitting it for tone, typos, and clarity. And if you feel very positive about the manuscript, you should get that across, too. It's not that everything needs to be negative. If there's points you want to make that either balance some limitations, or if you're simply saying you are very strongly favorable, you should get that across. Dilemma number two, reviewers provide too much or too little guidance to authors. It's not your job to redo the study or rewrite the paper, and it's not the job of the author necessarily. It may be beyond their capacity to do so, but if you can provide guidance on what would be the best work, what you would like to see done, that is particularly helpful. Sometimes very concise reviews that give concrete information on what would make it better are much more useful than longer reviews that are chattier or caught in the minutia. The third dilemma we talked about is that reviewers sometimes spend too much or too little time on the review. You need to develop a timeline of how long it usually takes you, set aside the required time, and stop. In my own experience, the best papers don't take nearly as long to review as the absolute worst papers. If you realize that you're reviewing something that you are going to recommend rejection, you can focus on the biggest points and convey things to the author. But you should not spend extensive amounts of time for longer on a review. Dilemma four, the reviewer uses too much or too little assistance. Sometimes there's an area that you need to get some feedback on, either because you're junior and you want to talk to one of your mentors about it, making it clear that you're talking about a manuscript that is under review. You can selectively ask for help from colleagues or from one of the editors. It's better to say there are limits on what I can do as a reviewer, and I'd like some input on how to handle this. And certainly when you're early on in reviewing, we recognize that you might need to get some guidance on how to write about one of your concerns, and we'd appreciate your doing that. But if you are aware that there are other areas of expertise that are needed, you don't feel confident, for example, with certain aspects of the statistical modeling, please point it out specifically to the reviewer so we can catch that and get that additional review as needed. Or if you feel confident in general in the substantive area, but it gets into some minutia of a special population that needs specialized care, saying so is very helpful. Dilemma five, should you, as a reviewer, agree to review? You should agree to review papers for which you have special expertise, for which you have interest. You also want to consider how many reviews you're going to do in a year, what works for you, and use that to accept and decline accordingly, taking into account how many submissions you do a year. Many people do a rather large number of reviews and use it as part of the way to stay on top of the literature, but you have to figure out what works for you and not have it in the way of other aspects of your work. I'm going to turn it over now to Lori to lead the next section. Lori, are you muted?
Lori, we just need you to switch screens, so I'm going to take control again real quick.
Okay.
And we'll try it again.
Okay.
So just hit that drop-down menu.
Put it back on my main monitor? On my main monitor?
If you hit that drop-down menu, you should be able to hover over the options and wait till the screen is highlighted, the one with the slides.
It's not working. It did it when we practiced.
No problem. Our audience is very patient and understanding when dealing with technology.
I don't think they are.
No problem. Okay, you're going to have it one more time.
It came back to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, there it is. Okay, no problem. Chloe, if I turn it over to you, would you be able to advance for her?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Well, this is my dog, Spock.
Let's see. Oops, sorry.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Chloe. Sorry. So what I would like to do is review some of the key criteria and things that you should check the manuscript for. There's not a specific order to these. They're all very important. But thinking about mistakes in procedures or logic related to, does the introduction set up for the methods that are going to be discussed? Really thinking about the conclusions and making sure that they're supported by the results of the paper. Frequently, authors will kind of go above and beyond their results in the conclusion, and we want to make sure that the conclusions are supported by the results. Certainly, it's helpful for the reviewers to look at errors or omissions in the references, especially if it's a field that you're particularly familiar with. Compliance with ethics standards making sure that if it was human subject research that the authors have noted that and have reported that they had IRB approval, that's important. And then probably the hardest thing to review for, I believe, is originality and significance of the work. That's a very important component, yet I think unless you know the literature extremely well, it's hard. That's the hardest thing for a reviewer to be able to comment on. Next slide, please. Other issues to consider as reviewers include the clarity of the research hypothesis, the originality of the work, which I've already mentioned. Is it new? Will it communicate something in particular to the journal's readership? It's possible that a topic could be new in one journal and have not reached that audience, and so that could be important. The strengths and weaknesses of the methodology, the approach, the interpretation, I think we're all used to being able to comment on those, and those are important. And then commenting some on the writing style, whether the figures and tables are presented in a way that the reviewer can really easily interpret them. And I think with the writing style, some of the reviewers, early reviewers, will get a little bit bogged down, and I know Chloe already mentioned this, with you know, trying to fix all the grammar. And I think that it's sometimes helpful to do some of that, but that's not the expectation that you're going to go through and fix all the grammar. I think that would be above and beyond what we're asking you to do as a reviewer. And ethical concerns, we're going to address some more in a few minutes. Next slide, please. So this is a way of organizing the review, thinking about overall how is the writing, is it clear and concise, thinking about the title. I think we frequently get so bogged down into looking at the text of the manuscript that we don't make sure that the title actually matches the results of the manuscript and that the abstract also matches. So one style that I have is that I review the manuscript and then go back and look at the title and the abstract to make sure that they fit with the text. But both of those are important, and really, you know, thinking about many manuscripts that we review or that we look at, you know, we only look at the abstract, so you really want to make sure that it matches the text. We've mentioned figures being clear, can stand alone, and the same with tables. And then there's the issue of using trade names, abbreviations, and symbols. We just have to be very careful. I think each journal kind of has guidelines on that, and following those are important. Next slide, please. So when you're a reviewer and you're trying to evaluate the quality of the work, you're looking at whether the methods are appropriate and in enough detail. Are the data adequate to support the conclusions? Do all the methods have results? I recently reviewed a manuscript where the opposite was true. There were results that didn't have methods. But you want to make sure that those match. And you can see how an author could make that mistake. You know, they start writing the manuscript and they're thinking about presenting it in a certain way, and then they get comments from their co-authors to change things. They may not have gone back around and made sure that their methods and results are matched, and that is important. And again, I probably will emphasize this about 3 or 4 times because it's a big issue that the conclusions are based on the actual results from the manuscript. Next slide. So Chloe and I were trying to think of some components of a high-quality review. What are the big things that, as editors, that we think it's important for reviewers or helpful for reviewers to address? And at this point, I actually should let the audience know that Chloe is an editor-in-chief of Women's Health Issues, and I am a deputy editor, so I'm not the editor-in-chief of Journal and general internal medicine. So we think that, you know, addressing readability, how well the paper's written, looking at grammar and spelling, but not getting too crazy on that part, and then giving some idea if the grammar, and it's not clear and concise, and you probably will know that by the first paragraph, you know, it's fine for you to say, I don't, you know, this paper is going to take so much rework, and letting us know that, you know, giving us a sense that that is important. And then some sense of length. Is the manuscript too long or too short? And are all the tables and figures needed? Those are very helpful for us as editors. Next slide, please. Again, commenting on the topic, the research question, does it seem important to you as a reviewer? Will it be relevant to the audience of the journal that it's being submitted to? Is it original? You know, are there mentions that IRB were approved and that there were no conflicts of interest and that the methodology is sound? You know, as Chloe mentioned, and I think I'd like to reemphasize that if the paper would seem to benefit from a statistical review, it's fine to say that. You don't have to. We do this all the time, and almost all journals have a statistical reviewer. And you can just say, I really think it would be important for somebody to take a look at method X. And so don't be afraid to do that. That's actually very helpful. If it doesn't make sense to you, it's probably not going to make sense to a whole lot of people. Next slide, please. You know, I think more on the methods in terms of some detailed suggestions on how to improve the paper. Maybe you think that everything's great up until they get to the logistic regression model, and then you would have done it completely different. You know, provide those kind of feedback to the author. Some of that is very changeable. Some of it's not. But if you really think it would be a whole lot better in a different way, giving that kind of feedback is very helpful. And then, you know, again, making sure that the authors of the manuscript really understand their own data, are not biased in their interpretation of their data, and they don't overreach their data. In other words, they don't, you know, they had some idea about what the conclusion should be, and even though their results don't quite show that, they're determined they're going to come to that conclusion. We don't want that kind of manuscript to be published. And then with regards to the discussion, did the authors, you know, place their results in the right context? Do they do an adequate literature review? Did they address the limitations? You know, again, is the paper novel? And did the conclusions really follow from the study rather than just a re-summary of the literature? Next slide, please. So I mentioned a literature search a couple of times. I think a quick literature search when you're asked to be a reviewer can be useful, particularly if you have questions about the novelty of the study. I think it can also be useful if you're wondering if the authors of the manuscript have published similar work before. And I think it can be useful if you're trying to put it into their findings into some context when you're looking at that sort of the first couple paragraphs of the discussion. And that way, a literature search can be very helpful, but we're not, as editors, expecting that you would do a literature search on every review that you do. Again, I think when you're doing a review and you're very familiar with the literature, all of this is a whole lot easier. And I think, again, I highlighted making sure the abstract and title agree with the body of the manuscript. That's something as an editor that's our job too, to look at that, but it's helpful if the reviewer can comment on that as well. So next slide, please. So, you know, when I was impressed that 75% of you have done 5 or more manuscript reviews, so you're quite familiar doing reviews. For those who aren't as familiar with reviewing, you'll know that you typically provide information for the reviewer. That's where you want to use nice language, be kind, pretend like it's you getting the comments, and provide detailed information about your review. But then you can also provide comments to the editors, and that might be where you say, you know, this was a great paper, but I'm pretty sure I've read this before. You might say, you know, you might give opinions to the editor about whether you think the manuscript is suitable for publication, and all these comments are confidential. They don't go to the author. Next slide, please. The confidential comments, we just kind of wanted to summarize what's helpful for the editor to receive from the reviewer are things like, you know, basically, are there any fatal flaws? Is this fixable or is this not fixable? Is this, you know, do you think the study design was really so poorly put forward that it's not fixable? That's kind of the information that we're interested in the confidential comments. And next slide. So we do want you to be consistent in what you say to the authors and what you say to us. So it really puts us in a bind when you say, you tell us, reject, this paper was awful, and then you say to the authors in their comments, beautiful paper, wonderful, will contribute to the literature. That really, you know, we're going to follow what you tell us in the comments to the editor, but the, you know, anyway, you get the point. If you really like the manuscript, I think it's really helpful for us for you to identify a couple major strengths of the manuscript, because, you know, we may have received three reviews and one person didn't like it, one person was on the fence, and then you really love it. So if you really love it, we need to know why you loved it and what are some of the major things that you think are strengths to the paper. And as I mentioned before, just give us a comment if you think it needs more editing. And now I will turn it back over to Chloe.
All right. And on that last point, sometimes what you think is a strength is what somebody else thought was a weakness, and it is helpful for us to line those up and say, well, okay, there's a difference of opinion here. So, and you need to keep in mind that a review, that you are seeing a privileged document. You are seeing somebody's intellectual work. So you need to be confidential in regard to the data, that this is the property of authors, that you should not disclose it to others except where you're specifically asking for some assistance in a review, acknowledging that this is, in fact, privileged information. You can't just take it back to your study team and go, oh my God, look, somebody's doing this other thing and it's cool, let's all read it and use it. After a final decision by the editor, you need to destroy that material. Certainly, if you liked it and it came out later and was published, it would probably be okay for you to say, you know, I may have been a reviewer on one of your things. If you didn't like it, I think you should keep that to yourself. Whether it comes out or not. Just, this is a private process. We have shared responsibility for the review of the manuscript. And so if you did draw a colleague into it, you need to let editors know, you know, that you turned to somebody who had some other insights. So reviewers should be reviewing manuscripts in an area of their expertise, be able to complete a review on time and let the journal know if you can't, if something changed. Avoiding conflicts of interest, you're not using the data for your own purposes, research, or to make the world a better place. You've got to wait until the something is published. Providing an honest and critical assessment, even if it's researchers you're in some way competing with on a topic. Even if you need to say, you know, I have a difference of a view from this, you can acknowledge that in a comment to the editor, so they can take it. We can take it into account. And you need to analyze the strengths and weaknesses. So the other point I really want to get to quickly is this part of the function of a reviewer is part of being an oversight of the ethics. Recognize in reporting, if you believe there's duplication in publication, if somebody has cut the slices too finely and this work is really largely published elsewhere, it's best if you speak up on that. If you recognize it's plagiarism, and I have known of cases where somebody recognized parts of their own work or other misrepresentations. That's a very strong claim. You may not want to make that to the authors, although you could allude to the issue. But this, that be forthright in your concern with that regard to the editor. But at least have made a point of concerns about similarities to other works in the parts to the authors. These ethics concerns will be followed up and handled by the editor and the publishers. And certainly, one of the points of having review of the strength of the methods, of recognition where you see there might be an alternative representation or where the data is too good to be true, this is often how those hopefully very rare cases of data fabrication or falsification are caught. That's part of what we want, is to know this is good and believable, or you have concerns and why. Some articles get rejected without external review. In most cases, the editor-in-chief or deputy editors evaluate the submission and determine whether they are put into the external review process. Sometimes this is fairly pro forma because something falls completely outside the domain of the journal, and other times it simply doesn't meet the standard for things sent out for review. We look to see that the language, the English language, is sufficient. It's well enough written. And sometimes we send things back saying, you know, that a strong, English as a first language co-author may be required. We put things back to people saying if they can submit a better version, they could put it back in, and we might be able to consider it. We also reject things if it's clearly the same work has been previously published, the data, the findings have been published. It is never okay to submit an article to multiple places at the same time. So because you're in a specific area with specific expertise, you may see something that got rejected at one journal and another journal gets it and it comes back to you. It is entirely appropriate to say, I think I saw an earlier version of this. If it seems far too recent, let us know. But if it seems to be overlapping, let both editors know, editors for both journals. For the review process, we start and send articles initially, manuscripts, to at least two reviewers. When invited, the reviewer gets the abstract, at least, to see if it fits with something that they agree. The editor generally requests the article be reviewed in 2 to 4 weeks. This varies depending on the journal and the journal cycle, but it's very important that you be able to do that. Or if you would be able, if you had a few weeks longer and are willing to do so, tell the editor, if you can't find somebody, I would be able to do it, but I can only do it by X. Articles then get revised until the reviewers agree or the editor decides that the concerns have been addressed or it's not going to be addressed and the paper's rejected. And then the reviewers' reports have helped the editors in making a decision throughout the process. If a report has not been received after 4 weeks or after whatever the window is, the editorial office will contact you. Please try not to leave things to the very last day because life happens and you may not be available to complete it. But if something has happened, let us know. Don't just sit quietly trying to deal with it. If there is a noticeable disagreement between reviewers, we may seek a third reviewer or an editorial board member, or someone to help with that decision. When one person said that this method is the strength, and another has said it's the weakness, we may go to another reviewer. But the anonymity of the reviewers is maintained unless the reviewer, for some reason, asks an editor to make their identity known. We protect your contribution. As I mentioned earlier, reviewers must not communicate with authors directly. All manuscripts and materials must be treated as confidential by us, our journal staff, and by you. We aim to have a decision to the author in 4 to 16 weeks, depending on the field, depending on the journal. The difficulty in obtaining reviewers and the lags that happen mean it gets pushed out very frequently to the high end of that or well beyond it. So in some disciplines, it may be 1 to 3 months or so on. So look to your colleagues of what's appropriate, when it's appropriate to talk to a journal about, if you're the author, about not having heard something. And then help to try to get things in on time. It's very important in meeting the schedule objectives, and it requires a lot of work on the part of a lot of people and a lot of administrative time on the journals. You should also treat authors as you would like to be treated. Try to say things in a constructive and helpful and respectful way. the most serious issues for authors to avoid and for reviewers to point out concerns about is fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism. If you have concerns about these, make some allusion to it in your review and make and raise it with the authors so that we can pursue it and look and see if there's a larger concern. It was a point of great discussion at an editor's conference I was at recently. Unethical behavior by researchers degrades the scientific record and the reputation of the science, of medicine, of research. It's very important that we address these issues and maintain ethical conduct. And these are just examples of some of the cases where a journal, something was published and then had to be retracted. And I know you're all aware of examples such as some of the vaccine research where it has caused tremendous damage having something get out that was inappropriate. What is plagiarism? Well, plagiarism is the appropriation of another person's ideas, processes, results, or words without giving proper credit. And that includes those obtained through confidential reviews. So oft, at times you will see in a published article that an additional analysis, a change was made at the request or based on feedback from an anonymous reviewer. That's an appropriate way to handle those things. But you should give credit where credit is due, just as you would want it. To use people's data, interpretations, or ideas without crediting them is theft. We all should be above that. Correct citation is key. This means placing your work in context, acknowledging the findings of others on which your research is built, and it helps to maintain the credibility and accuracy of the scientific literature. It helps readers and other researchers be able to work back and understand the literature that you're building upon or where you're referring to a debate in the literature. I'm going to hand it back to Lori now. Just tell me and I will cue forward the slide.
Lori, do you want to try sharing your screen again or should we just continue on as we are?
Going on. I have no idea why it didn't work.
Okay, no problem. We'll continue on.
So I'm going to just talk for a few minutes and then we're going to open up to questions about conflicts of interest. And providing some examples here, and basically the question is, which of the following are examples of conflicts of interest? A university researcher who owns stock in a large oil company conducts an experiment on the environmental effects of oil drilling. A university researcher who's developing and testing new technology is also a consultant for a financial services firm that weighs investments in new technology. A researcher who submits an article to a journal for which the editor-in-chief is a professor in the researcher's department, and a doctor who abides by traditional healing procedures writes a paper on emerging current medical technologies. So next slide, please. So the point is that all of these are potential conflicts, all of those examples, and that basically, conflicts can take many different forms, from direct financial, including stock ownership, to indirect financial, such that you are a consultant or you've received an honorarium, career and intellectual in terms of whether it affects promotion, and then personal beliefs can also present conflicts of interest. So the proper way to handle potential conflicts of interest is through transparency and disclosure. And at the journal level, this means disclosing your potential conflict in your cover letter to the journal editor. So I think it's just putting it out there and letting somebody else make that decision. One other thing that we wanted to just touch on because we thought this might come up as a question is regarding authorship. Who deserves, if you will, or who should be named as an author on a manuscript. And so here's a situation where a researcher completes her paper, and along the way she consulted her advisor for guidance on the experiment, the data analysis, and writing and revising the final article. You know, should that advisor be a co-author? Another example is a professor in India assisted her in analyzing the data only, or a lab assistant helped her in preparing the experimental design and operating the equipment, or maybe two grad students read her paper and edited it, though they had no hand in the experiment. So the question would be, who should be listed as an author and who should be listed first? So next slide. So here are some policies to address authorship, and they can vary. Different journals have some different guidelines, but in general, an author should substantially contribute to the conception, design, or acquisition of the data or analysis and the interpretation of data, draft the article or revise it critically for important content, and give their approval of the final version to be published. And all three conditions must be fulfilled to be an author. So if we apply this set of policies to our example, only the researcher, the person who was initially writing the paper, and her advisor would qualify as authors. And all the others, if you remember, the grad students who helped her edit the paper, the lab tech who helped her with the experiments and the equipment, the person from India who did the analysis, those would all be qualify as acknowledged individuals. Next slide, please. And basically, the points that we wanted to make here with regards to authorship are really things to be avoided. We don't want authors to be left out who contributed. We don't this notion of ghost authors, and we, you know, basically don't want people to just be given the opportunity to be a co-author when they didn't contribute significantly. Those are things to avoid. Next slide, please. And thinking a little bit about the consequences for some of the issues that we brought up, including like plagiarism that Chloe brought up, the potential consequences and actions by the publisher can vary quite a bit, to be honest. And it could include things like written letters of concern and reprimand. It could include article retractions. And I think sometimes it can go to as far as disciplinary action on the part of the researcher's institute or the funding body, in, for example, of NIH or the or VA was aware of those kinds of actions. Next slide, please. So we wanted to save, and we almost did, 15 minutes of time for questions and comments. And we also, as Chloe mentioned earlier, wanted to thank Elsevier for their slide deck that we used and to develop some of our slides and to get some content here for this presentation. And here are our email addresses. If you wanted to email us separately, that would be great. But we hope now that you might provide us with some feedback or some questions. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you to you both. We do have some good pending questions, and I just want to let our audience members know to submit your questions and comments. Just use the question section of the GoToWebinar dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen. You can just click the plus sign next to the word questions, and that'll expand the dialog box where you can then submit them. So this first question came in, and I believe it was when you were talking about telling the submitter that you liked their paper, but not recommending it for publishing to the editor. And the question that came in is, why wouldn't you communicate this directly to the author?
It depends on your level of confidence or concern about the problem. I think the main issue is you don't have to be prepared to directly address an author. You may have some degree of uncertainty, These are big assertions to throw around. If you are quite confident, it is certainly acceptable for you to make the comments directly to the author and affirm them to the editor.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misconstrued that. They were speaking. I meant more, what is the point of confidential comments?
To the editor? The point is sometimes you might add, you were a little on the fence. Sometimes you might add, I had uncertainty about a specific, I'd like the view of somebody else who's also used this method, or so on, if you have any qualifications. It is not the case that there are always any comments provided to the editor, but it may just be a take-home point.
Thank you for that reply. The next question starts out with a comment. The process of science requires confirmatory studies. How do you balance the desire for, quote, novelty in a study with the importance of confirmatory work for establishing the evidence-based? Do you think there is such a thing as an important confirmatory study?
I certainly do. There are replications that are useful, and then there's a point where we've seen things many, many times, and a specific replication or a specific look in a specific population may not add to the literature. Lori, what do you think?
Oh, I agree, and I think that the important thing, though, is to make sure that the confirmatory study acknowledges that other studies have been done before.
Excellent. Thank you both for those replies. Can you speak to the concern about predatory journals? It can be hard to distinguish predatory versus legit journals when we are asked to review.
Personally, there are some Google, some lists online that you can actually put in a journal name and predatory and get some suggestions of probable predatory journals. I would suggest that you focus mainly on journals that you know of or that you can look and get some legitimate information about. But there are certainly times as an editor that I reach out to people who haven't published in our journal, who may not follow it regularly, who could be very, very helpful. It helps that our journal was longstanding and a print journal. But with new journals coming up at an astounding rate, it takes more looking to make sure you know what you're dealing with.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, is there a particular format or structure for organizing a review that you find particularly helpful?
Personally, and then I want to hear what Lori says, I'd like to see the main points, the biggest concerns laid out at the top, and then the rest of the concerns, more minor or methodological or easily addressable issues or things that address specific paragraphs or pages to be in a separate category, so it's not just a mishmash. But the more well-organized it is easier for us and for the author to tell they've addressed your concerns and to understand them. But have you seen particularly good ways of doing this, Lori?
Chloe, I completely agree with what you said. I like to see the big comments, and then I like to see the minor comments identified as fairly minor comments, and then structured, starting with the title, abstract, intro, methods, results, discussion. And that way, if you can do the minor, at least the minor comments that way, it's so much easier to follow for the editors and the authors.
Well, and I just wanted to add, if you are fairly new to submitting articles or to doing reviews, the best resubmissions take those comments and go through them very systematically, and they'll often say, this was addressed on page blah, 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 this is addressed to this place. And it makes it very easy, either internally or for reviewers, to look and say, those things are handled. I want to focus on these couple of points and see if they were dealt with. It could speed up your path through publication and review.
Thank you both for those replies. It looks like we've got about five pending questions. Given the competing demands to publish and obtain grant funding, how many reviews would you recommend an early career researcher agree to complete annually? Also, can you comment on the process of becoming an editorial board member of a journal?
Taking into account that each article you submit is probably going to require 5 reviews out there in the world somewhere, if you're submitting, you know, 3 things a year, probably doing 6 reviews and being sure that some of your other co-authors are doing some of them related to it as well would be kind of sharing your weight. But doing more than 1 every other month or so, you need to make sure that you are getting efficient enough at it and that you are getting something out of it. You're focusing well enough on the areas of your expertise that it is rewarding and you're getting a sense of what's happening in the literature you're working in. Obviously, there's a point of diminishing returns, but I think it's going to vary for different people, and articles in different fields and different areas have different lengths and technical requirements. So it may not always take the same amount of time for different people. So I'm not sure there's a precise answer. As for becoming a deputy editor, I think it's going to vary with different kinds of journals, but it takes to reach that level. Normally, you're going to have reviewed a fair bit for the specific journal and have come up through the world in that sense and made yourself known to an editor. But if you're interested in reviewing more, interested in that, certainly speak up. Lori, can you talk a little bit about the deputy editor process or position?
Sure. And so, yes, I think exactly what you said, you know, connect yourself with a deputy editor. The deputy editors tend to be well-connected with the editors-in-chief at the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Our 2 editors-in-chief, our co-editors, Rich Kravitz and Mitch Feldman, they're always looking for eager deputy editors, and they're looking for, they have in their minds deputy editors in specific areas that they're interested in and filling those positions. So I think, you know, you could always contact the editors-in-chief and express your interest or connect with one of the deputy editors, for example, at the annual meeting, and talk to them about that.
And make sure that it is valued by your department or the senior leadership you report to. This is, and that you know how much reviewing would be expected. It is easy to tip too far in the direction of service work or into something that's not valued enough that you need to understand how you're going to fulfill on that. It might work for you. It might be personally rewarding, or it might turn out to be too much too soon.
Thank you both for those replies. The next question, as a reviewer, I have seen manuscripts with a famous first author who has a well-known writing style. However, the manuscript that is actually submitted sounds nothing like that researcher's prior work, leading us to believe that a junior author is doing the work and not getting credit. How do you address this as a reviewer?
Wow, that's a big one. If I face that, I would probably start with some comments to the in the comments to the editor. But it is also possible that the reviewer is writing somewhat differently on a different topic or in a different area. So to look to see, is there a reason, or it would make sense, or it is more collaborative in this one, or does it note that their authors are simply listed alphabetically? But you can raise that question if it's an unblinded review. If it's a blinded review, you technically don't know who it is, and you might need to be more circumspect in explaining that. But often it's the style that can cue me that a specific person is likely the author in a blinded review. Have you had experience with this sort of thing, Lori?
I really haven't, no, but I think that comes to the place where that reviewer is so familiar with that area of literature that they can make that, you know, they can have that. And I, as an editor, I would like to, you know, have that something to put in the confidential comments to the editor, and I would figure out what I was going to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And if you were very concerned and it was not blinded, it would be okay to say, this seems a very different style from the author's, you know, normal work, especially if the other you think would be more compatible, or if it's, you know, a question, you could allude to it in the main text. What else?
Thank you both. We do have three pending questions, but I know it's at the top of the hour. Are you two available to stay on and answer those for the recording?
Sure.
Excellent. Thank you so much. If our attendees need to drop off, we do understand, but I do have to say, if you do exit out of the session, please wait just a moment while the feedback survey pops up on your screen. It's just a few questions, but we do read your replies very closely, and it helps us to plan our future sessions and improve the ones we've already had. The next question, if you discuss something with a colleague, does this disclosure go in the comments to the editors, and do you name the person?
Lori, how would you expect this to be handled?
You know, I think if you shared the manuscript with a colleague, and I would think you would do that because you really had a specific question about something, and so you really wanted to, you valued that colleague's input on that specific issue, then yes, I think you would share that. I would share that in the comments to the editor. If you basically just kind of ran by an idea to a colleague, have you ever seen, you know, statistics X done this way or something like that, I don't know that then you really need to acknowledge that person. So I think it really depends.
Mm-hmm. Or you might say, you know, I was concerned about something and I ask about the general presentation of the methods, and I thought it would be much more helpful to have had a more detailed discussion of this method, or for additional information to be included in this table. What is appropriate may vary because a method is newer or more of an outlier in a particular journal. It may require more explanation. And conveying that you talk to somebody with statistical expertise or different clinical expertise can help the editor know the value and the type of information that was garnered.
Excellent. Thank you both for those replies. The next question. In the context of interdisciplinary work, there is often a dominant language or lexicon of the primary discipline associated with the journal. This can discourage authors from other disciplines from writing authentically in their own lexicon. When is a good time to open a dialogue about this with the journal?
I think you can attempt to open a dialogue with the journal, but it's unlikely that as one individual you're necessarily going to sway what is, as I was talking about earlier, an entire conversation. But I've seen it done where, in fact, one of my mentors, you know, wrote back and said, actually, you know, this discipline is working on this, and I'd like to do it, and I'd like to include these things. And sometimes it flies, and sometimes it doesn't. But it's worth asking when you get your reviews back, or if you, as a reviewer, are reviewing something and you feel like the process of shifting to the language of a different field outside your own is our discipline outside your own is co-opting and underrepresenting the contribution of some work. I think it's entirely appropriate to say, I think that more attention needs to be paid to the psychological or whatever literature that this is built upon. And that's not an uncommon kind of comment for somebody to make. But be specific enough that they can act on it and address, that an author could act on it and address your concern.
Thank you. The final pending question we have, how do you address the issue of, quote, slicing the salami too thinly? In this day and age of large databases where multiple publications are expected but not planned a priori?
I think that the first thing you need to do is, if you're slicing the data very, you know, and you're in a bunch of pieces, I think you need to make sure that you cite all those other pieces of salami in the manuscript,
mm-hmm.
so that people can compare and determine. So, but by people, I mean first the reviewers and editors, and if it passes that, then other readers of the manuscript can compare what was done in the different issues. You know, I think the big mistake that people make is not citing the other pieces that they've worked on. That, to me, is not a good thing to do.
Yeah, and all of them might be a lot, depending on what kind of, what you're talking about. The tremendous amount of work's been done with the Women's Health Initiative. What might be most important is to cite some key pieces that lay out the study. And the pieces that are actually closest to it, you ought to be comfortable, the author ought to be comfortable saying, these are these other two pieces that are closest to this, and this is how it's different, and it does add enough novelty, enough of a contribution. And if as a reviewer you feel like those are missing, then that's a comment that I get and I take very seriously. And I will go and look at the specific piece, or even before making a decision to send something out for review, there are tools for looking for the most similar manuscripts, and some things get sent back purely on not being unique enough. And it's up to the author to make the case that this is a contribution. This adds considerable or significant enough value to be an independent piece.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, those are the final pending questions, but I would like to give each of you an opportunity to make any concluding comments that you'd like to.
Lori?
Just thank the audience for paying attention, and that we appreciate it. It was a joy to work with Chloe on this, and I appreciate the invitation to give the presentation.
The same here. As an editor, I just so appreciate the contribution that good reviewers make. You are highly valued. It is important to your own research and to the discipline as a whole. We couldn't do this without this kind of collaborative effort. And so I hope this is helpful in people learning something about what they can do and how they can do it in order to carry out the responsibilities of a reviewer efficiently and effectively. And maybe it'll also add some value as you pursue your own research and writing.
Excellent. Well, I too want to thank our audience for joining us, and of course I'd like to thank you too for lending your expertise to the field, and to Barbara Elspas for helping us coordinate this CDA Cyber Seminar series. So for our attendees, once again, as you exit out of today's session, wait just a second while the feedback survey populates on your screen. As I mentioned, we do read your responses very closely, and it helps guide the direction our program goes into. So thanks again, ladies, and everybody have a wonderful rest of the day.